a pleasure to be here. He was talking about the science fiction books. I once made a joke to an audience at Stanford about how the lab I was in had this special advantage because of my publishing, that we actually were the only lab in the department that published its science fact and science fiction in separate journals. But nobody laughed, and so I haven't actually used that yet. Let's go. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the role that sleep plays in learning and memory consolidation, just to sort of repeat. Oh, it's not here, so I'm fine. We have not had a chance to talk yet about the actual architecture of a night's sleep, so just perhaps for some of you in the audience, I wanted to go over it. A normal night of sleep consists of a sequence of a 90-minute cycle of REM sleep and non-REM sleep, with that deep sleep occurring mostly in the early part of the night and the REM sleep in the late part of the night, with this lighter stage 2 non-REM sleep being distributed more or less evenly throughout the night. And the hypothesis I want to put forward today is that it might be that this complex orchestration of different brain states, as it turns out, across the night occurred because there are a number of different types of processes involved in taking memories and consolidating, enhancing, and integrating them that require different cellular and molecular and neuromodulatory microenvironments. And that these stages actually evolved originally in part to meet this need for different conditions, for different types of memory processing. Now, one of the problems, aside from the different stages of sleep, is the different types of memory that we're going to have to talk about. One form of memory is called procedural skill learning, and this can involve perceptual tasks, learning as we do when it's safe to turn and when it isn't, or how to reach into our pocket and pull out a nickel and not get a quarter by mistake. These are perceptual skills that we learn over time. And then there's motor skills that we learn as well, and some of these can be things like gymnastics, basketball, the cello, or even in the end, surgery. You might think of surgery as a skill that involves learning specific facts, but when I ask someone how many hours of classroom experience do you want a surgeon to have before you let him operate on you if he's never cut before, the answer is usually that won't do it. They have to have the actual experience of doing the skill in order to learn it effectively. So one of the things I'm going to talk about at the start is how procedural skills benefit from sleep. Now, I want to make something clear. There's been a lot of discussion this morning about the impact of sleep or an absence or restriction thereof on your ability to perform or to learn. This is a very different type concept I'm talking about here. This is the role that sleep has after you learn something. So you learn something during the day, and then you either sleep or you sleep less or you don't sleep at all the next night. And how does that impact how that memory is retained over a night of sleep? So let me start with a rather simple task. This is a perceptual task where subjects are shown screens like this. They're flashed briefly, and there's going to be three diagonal bars in the lower left quadrant of the visual field that might be in a column like this or in a row, and subjects are just asked to identify whether they saw a row of those diagonal bars or a column. And we can flash it faster or slower and find how fast we can go before they lose the ability to perceive it. And then we train them up on this, send them away and bring them back later. And the idea is that if they've learned something in that training session, then their brain will be able to process that information faster the next time they take the test, and so their threshold for detection will be lowered. And we just look at the difference between those thresholds to see how much better they've gotten. Well, if we train people and test them later the same day, we see this whopping lack of improvement. There's absolutely no significant improvement at all if we train people and retest them the same day. But if instead of testing them that day, we wait until the next day, or the next day, or the next, or the next, or out to a week, we see this large and robust improvement in the speed with which they can determine the orientation of that array of three diagonal bars. And even a single night of sleep gives you about, this is about a 15% increase in speed and how fast the brain can process that information. In Boston, I like to say that a 15% difference in speed is the difference between coming in first and 3,000th in the Boston Marathon. It's an impressive difference. So it's clear that this memory is improving without practice over time. But why do I say this has anything to do with sleep? Well, we take a group of subjects and we sleep deprive them this first night. And then we let them have all the sleep they want on the second night, all the sleep they want on the third night, bring them in 72 hours later, they're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, quote, completely recovered from their night of sleep deprivation, and we test them, and there's nothing there. You cannot gain this benefit of sleep on your ability to perform this task unless you sleep on the first night. Now, we can bring people into the sleep laboratory and look at their sleep and ask which components of the sleep might correlate with this improvement. And it turns out that you need both slow-wave sleep early in the night and REM sleep late in the night, or you won't show any improvement. And that looks like this, where this is the product of slow-wave sleep in the first quarter and REM sleep in the last quarter of the night, explaining 80% of the variance. So 80% of the difference between these subjects and how much they improved can be explained simply by the product of these two sleep parameters. So as I tell my very dejected students at Harvard, it doesn't matter what your SAT scores were or where you went to prep school or how much your mother makes. It depends on how well you sleep the night after you are trained on this task that determines how much improvement you're going to show. Now, that was a perceptual task. This is a motor task. It's a relatively simple one. You're going to type on a keyboard the sequence 41324 over and over as quickly and accurately as you can with your left hand. If you try it, you'll find that it's an ugly sequence, intentionally so. But over 12 minutes of training, subjects plateau at about 22 completed sequences in a 30-second trial. So here's what that looks like. We can train them in the morning or in the evening. It doesn't really matter. They're going to be 22 to 23 sequences. We send them away. We bring them back 12 hours later, and we retest them. Well, if they had a chance to sleep in between, you see this large 20% increase, highly significant. Whereas if it's been 12 hours of wake, this increase is about the leftover slope that we were seeing at the end of training. This is probably just the additional practice of these two or three trials that we give them as we're testing them. And this, of course, is not a sleep deprivation paradigm. It's not that one group got to sleep and the other were deprived. This is normal daytime waking versus normal sleep. So it looks like you need to be trained in the evening if you want to show this overnight improvement. But fortunately, evolution has figured out that we stay up all day. So if we bring them back 12 hours later, this group over the 12 hours of wake show no change, but this group, which now gets to sleep, shows the large improvement and brings you up to essentially the same level. So you need to sleep within about 24 hours of training to see this benefit. But if you do, on average, you'll get a 20% increase in speed. And by the way, there's about a 30% increase in accuracy as well. So we're not talking a speed-accuracy trade-off. Both speed and accuracy get better. What part of sleep looks responsible? Well, now the correlation is with stage 2 non-REM sleep. And, I thought I had a graph. I apologize. And here the correlation coefficient is about 0.7, explaining about half the variance between subjects. So it looks like for a motoric task, stage 2 might be critical, while for the visual discrimination task, these REM and slow wave are critical. And so it's important to keep in mind that it's not a question of which stage of sleep is important for learning any more than it's a meaningful question to ask which vitamin is it that's important for health. Each of these vitamins, each of these stages of sleep plays a separate and distinct role in these processes. So those were procedural memories, learning how, memories for how to do things, which is different from the classic type of memory that we think of, which is memory of what or for events. This is called declarative memory, and it's generally divided into two categories: episodic memory, memories for events in your life, for episodes, and semantic memory, memory for just everyday facts that we've learned. So classic examples of declarative memory would be the Challenger explosion or the World Trade Center, both of which most everybody in the audience can remember where they were, what they were doing. They can recreate the memory of the episode in their minds. That's different from the semantic memory, which would cover things like the explosion of the Hindenburg, which most of you probably learned about at some point, or this list that everybody has committed to memory, the presidents of the United States. And this type of sort of memorizing of facts where we have no idea where we learn them. So how many people know how much 5 plus 5 is? No. Oh, good. but nobody remembers where they were when they learned it. So the brain has rather elegantly stripped away all of the surroundings of that event, that episode where you learned 5 plus 5, and just kept the critical fact. This is one of the most amazing things that the brain does, actually, is to take in information, for example, today, tons and tons of information and memories formed, so that when you leave here, you'll be able to remember where you sat in here, where you sat out there for lunch, what the size of your badge was. In a month, all of that will be gone, and only, hopefully, a few good facts from the presentations will be left. So that stripping away is a critical function of the brain's memory system, and actually might also be a process that's largely sleep-dependent. But I'm getting ahead of myself because I want to talk about examples of sleep and declarative memory. This is a task that actually Jessica Payne and Ruth Proper carried out in my lab. I apologize if I don't read these names all the time. You all know that we who speak up here don't do these experiments by ourselves. So whenever I said I did something or I found something, I mean we. And in fact, whenever I say we did something, I mean they did. Okay, so so we looked at this study of lists of words. And what Jessica had is she had subjects here, a spoken list of 8 lists, each of which consisted of sets of closely related words, like these words are all related. And then she would do a memory test afterwards. And to give you a sense of what that looks like, the instruction would be, remember these words, you're going to be tested on them later. And then this would normally be followed a few moments later by a second list and a third for 8 lists. And then they would come back later and be tested on it. And they might see a recognition test like this one. So I'm going to show you words. If you saw it on this list, raise your hand. If it wasn't on the list, don't. And now I have to explain. This is not raising your hand, right? This is not raising your hand. This is the elbow, and the elbow is supposed to be stiff, okay? So raise your hand if you saw this word. No takers, okay. Good. Okay. 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 So the fact that up to 80% of you will false alarm on the word doctor is because that's the way this whole test is set up. All of the words you actually saw were selected because they are directly and strongly linked to this critical lure or gist. This word here is the gist of this list. And remember I talked a minute ago about how we forget most of the details and hold that what's important. If you go home this evening and talk to your partner or your spouse about this, you say, oh, he showed a bunch of words related to doctor, like, I don't know, hospital or something. Because what you need to remember is the word doctor. Now, what's very powerful about this particular paradigm is it lets Sarah, our next speaker, Sorry, it lets Jessica test both for actual recall of the words that were on the list and false recall for these gist lures that people tend to get by mistake. So what happens? Well, she trains one group and tests them 30 minutes later just to get baseline levels, and then the others are tested after 12 hours, again, either across the day or across the night. If she tests them across the day and looks at the studied words, they forget about, about 45% of the words by that evening. In contrast, if she trains them in the evening and tests them the next morning, they only forget about 30%. So there's about a one-third savings. If you sleep across those 12 hours instead of staying awake. These are for actual words that were, this is getting too dim. I can't be by manual, I don't think. For words that were actually studied. What about those gist lures? Well, it turns out that they forget about 25% of the gist lures across the day, but look what happens across the night. They actually go up a little bit. It's not significant, but there's no hint of any deterioration. And it's as if what the brain is particularly doing across the night is not just stabilizing and maintaining these memories, but doing so specifically and preferentially for those gist memories, that extracting of the meaning, if you will, of the list from the actual words that you saw. So we've talked about procedural memories. We've talked about declarative memories. I haven't given you an example of episodic memory. This is sort of a cross between episodic and semantic because the linkage is semantic, but the episode is what you're remembering the words from. There's a third type of memory that sleep seems to play an important role in, and that's what Carlisle Smith up in Canada has referred to as complex cognitive procedural memories. And like the procedural memories, it's about how to do things, but on a much more complex level. So it's things like how to pick the right line when you're going through security to get through as fast as possible. It's things like where to put that piece when it falls down to the bottom. Okay? It's things like what the right move to make at this point in this game is. Or it can be something as simple as, should I take my umbrella with me today? Now, these are all things that we learn from multiple examples to extract some rules from. And if you talk to a chess master about why they would make a certain move at that point, they say, it's the best move. And they can't tell you rules because the actual declarative list of rules are unknown to people when they make decisions like that. So what I'm going to actually show you now is how sleep helps this kind of extraction of rules from examples. And I'm actually going to use a weather prediction task. So this is a task that Ina Janlogic and Andy Rosenfeld have been working on. What happens is the subject is shown one, two, or three of these cards at a time and asked to predict whether it's going to be sunny or rainy. Okay? As you might expect, they start out pretty close to chance. So they might see this card, and then it turns out that it predicts sunny. And then they might see these two cards together, and it predicts rain. And then they see this one, and they say, oh, okay, at least I know what this one's going to, and it doesn't. Okay? So this is a probabilistic learning task in the sense that each of the cards is associated with sun a certain percentage of the time, but never 100% with one outcome or the other. So whenever you see the diamond, alone or with some of these others, there's an 80% chance that it'll turn out to be sunny, but not 100%. And as we train people, they slowly extract the rules, often in a way that they cannot describe. We train them with 200 trials, with feedback, as you see it here, and then we just test them. We do another 100 trials, and they just guess without any feedback whether it's going to be sunny or rainy. They go away for 12 hours. They come back, and we test them again. Now, this would seem to be a place where it's hard to imagine that there's anything for sleep to do. Well, when you do this across the day, you, in fact, don't see any improvement between the two sessions. Remember, when they did the first test, they were getting no feedback, so you wouldn't expect them to get better from that testing. But when we train them in the evening and bring them back the next day, they're actually about 10% more accurate. The brain somehow, while you're sleeping, is able to take some information that it's gleaned from these 200 trials. And I guarantee you, they haven't memorized the 200 trials. But embedded in the networks of the cortex is information about these trials that the brain is able to continue to evaluate and investigate during sleep, producing this profound improvement over the night of sleep. Well, that pretty much summarizes all I want to say now. I've had most of my time talking this morning, it turns out. The take-homes are that sleep enhances memories. It makes them stronger, it makes them more effective, and it can help form new memories, if you will, by extracting rules from large samples of information. Different stages of sleep enhance different types of memory. We saw that with the two procedural tasks. And all stages of sleep may contribute. I haven't shown you data, but we even have data for that early stage one sleep that comes at the very start of the night for a possible role for stage one sleep and contribute in memory consolidation. And as I stated at the beginning, maybe this is the reason these sleep stages evolved originally. Now, I want to make very clear that I'm talking about a function of sleep and not the function of sleep. I'm very sorry that we didn't get to have Ev Van Cauter out here, who could present compelling data about immune function, neuroendocrine function, being critically dependent on getting enough sleep. And others might talk about other functions of sleep. Sleep is a time that evolved at one point, and once it evolved, it was the goal of future evolution to figure out everything it could pack into those 8 hours, 2 hours, 5 hours, 19 hours, everything that it can pack in there to make that the most productive time possible. But this is the one we've been studying, and we're very happy to be able to say at this point that the evidence is clear that in many domains of memory processing, memory consolidation, memory enhancement even, sleep plays an important and critical role. Thank you.
So we'll take some questions. By the way, Louise Lucey will probably get into orexins and hypocretin, so we'll get into the sort of dietary stuff absolutely. As well.
So one of the things that you said was that sleep helps in these cognitive procedural tasks to bring out the rules, but then you said that the experts don't actually know what the rules are. So how could it bring out the rules if you actually don't have access to them?
So if I said they bring out the rules...
Well, that was my words, okay. but they somehow get crystallized, right?
So somehow we have in our brains all sorts of information that we use without knowing it. How many of you feel confident that if I gave you a sheet of paper, you could quickly write down the way to tell from a photograph whether an animal is a dog or a cat? We got a few hands. No one has any trouble telling a dog from a cat. We have that knowledge, but we don't know it in a declarative way. We don't know exactly what it is about the face of a cat that makes it obvious that it's a cat. If we study it, if you go back home now and look at your dog and your cat, you'll say, oh, I see. But that's information that we have in a non-declarative form. So what's happening in this extraction of rules is that it's staying at a bottom-up network descriptive type of level.
Well, the reason I'm bringing it up is that there's a big debate about whether or not there really are rules in the brain, right? Between the cognitive people who really believe that and a lot of the neuroscientists who are interested in neural networks, which behave as if there are rules there, but there aren't. They're just a lot of neurons and signals.
So, thank you. My guess is that in these situations, there is no physical instantiation of rules in the brain. Just like you can't tell me now what the difference between a cat and a dog is, if you sat down and looked at it, you could discover it. but you don't know it ahead of time. So I would agree with you that this type of processing specifically is involved in this type of extraction without the formation of actual rules, but just a tuning, if you will, of a discriminator that allows you to tell a cat from a dog. I mean, think about it. Kids, you show them three cats, three dogs, and say, that's a kitty, that's a dog. It takes about three of each, and they've got it down. But they're not going to know what that down is. They can just use those networks to answer the question. Do you want to... Our runners are gone. They're...
Can I just comment on? I mean, the visual system is developed with before even development happens with orientation selective cells, and if you want to call those rules for our visual system, color selective cells, which are also rules for our visual system. So, if you want to think about it in terms of cats versus dogs, cats have very different oriented eyes. They have very different oriented noses. So these things are visual rules for us.
Yes, but most people, when they look at a picture of a cat, don't say, which way are the eyes turned? Does the nose look like it protrudes? Or it's fast and it's simple. It's the old argument about whether we use word recognition or phonetics for spelling. And word recognition is much faster than phonetics. It's not that many of us don't know the rules. It's not that rules couldn't be extracted from these networks. It's just that the way we tend to learn most things, even in such things as, you know, should I raise my hand to shake with them, are learned by multiple examples and a shaking down of those networks to form functional patterns of behavior that are actually enacted without a clear understanding of the rules behind it. They are there, but that's not what we're using. They're there at a formalistic level.
As a follow-up point to Terry and Sarah, what if we're not as good as learning new rules as we are just recognizing junk? So in some of these examples which you've shown, another explanation could have been that we are just very good at figuring out spurious associations and getting rid of them, which means that the set of solutions is not unique, and therefore you don't need to have a rule.
Okay, I'm not sure that I followed all of it, but certainly a part of what you're saying is this doesn't have to be the strengthening of what you want to keep.
That's right.
It can be the weakening of what you don't want to keep. And Giulio Tononi will certainly push that argument tomorrow, I'm sure. That's an absolutely equivalently effective explanation for what's going on. In some cases, it might not... Well, no, probably technically from a network perspective, that would always work. So we can't distinguish. He's basically saying if what lets you answer one of these questions successfully is a signal-to-noise ratio, you can raise the signal or you can drop the noise. And I don't think we really have good cellular, molecular, physiological data yet to distinguish between those two.
Right. But I'm not as much referring to Tononi's work, because in his case, you use LTD just to make sure that you maintain the dynamic range of synapses. So you don't actually lose much information. I'm more referring to the Crick-Mitchison hypothesis.
Okay. So the Crick-Mitchison hypothesis that we, officially that we dream to forget, but let's broaden it to we sleep to forget, means that there is some active process that identifies bits of information that are not worth keeping, and selectively erases them, if you will. And that's also very possible. I mean, if you look at the work of Gina Poe, who's at Michigan now, she'll train rats on a maze and then record from the hippocampus and find that the cells that map to the areas that the maze is represented in the brain, in the hippocampus, that shortly after training, when this memory is totally dependent on the hippocampus, a deep structure in the brain, that the firing is in phase with one of these sleep rhythms called theta waves, which is known to enhance the strengthening of synaptic connections. While a week later, at the point that the memory has sort of moved out to the cortex and is no longer dependent on the hippocampus, that activation has shifted so that it's now in phase with the troughs of those theta waves, which is a condition that's known to cause erasure or weakening of those synaptic connections. So sleep might be doing both of those things, strengthening it when that's useful, weakening it when that's useful.
I wonder if that's something that Terry will get into later on with the replay and so on. So let's go to Sarah now, if we can. Thank you, Bob, very much.